From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. An accusation of war crimes against Israel in Gaza made by the head of the UN Human Rights Council. Patrick Maigwa reports from Geneva.
Condemning Israel for not taking all necessary precautions to protect civilian lives in Gaza, the UN Human Rights Chief Navi Pillay says there is a strong possibility that international humanitarian law had been violated in a manner that could amount to war crimes. Addressing the UN Human Rights Council at the start of a session to discuss the situation in Gaza, Ms. Pillay said 70% of those killed in Gaza since the start of the latest Israeli military operation were civilians. She said the lack of distinction between civilians and combatants had resulted in the death of several Palestinian children. The High Commissioner said the indiscriminate firing by Hamas and other armed groups of more than 2,900 rockets into Israel was equally unacceptable, noting that Israeli civilians also have a right to live without fear. More than 600 Palestinians, including at least 147 children and 74 women, have so far been killed, while two Israeli civilians have been killed by rockets and other projectiles fired from Gaza.
The disregard for international humanitarian law and for the right to life was shockingly evident for all to see in the apparent targeting on 16th July of seven children playing on a Gaza beach. Four of them, aged between 9 and 11, from the same Bakr family, were killed. These children were clearly civilians taking no part in hostilities. I unequivocally reiterate to all actors in this conflict that civilians must not be targeted. It is imperative that Israel, Hamas, and all Palestinian armed groups strictly abide by applicable norms of international humanitarian law and international human rights law. Respect for the right to life of civilians, including children, should be a foremost consideration. Not abiding by these principles may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
The High Commissioner said all violations of international law must be properly and independently investigated. Patrick Maigwa, United Nations, Geneva.
Late Wednesday, the Council agreed to launch an international inquiry into violations that may have been committed during Israel's latest military offensive in Gaza. Navi Pillay, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, also condemned Hamas, the political movement that was elected to rule Gaza in 2006, and other armed groups for what she called indiscriminate attacks on Israel. Pillay also called for an end to the blockade of Gaza, the underlying reason for the conflict, and an issue that will have to be tackled if any ceasefire is to endure. At the end of an emergency session Wednesday, the 47-member council adopted a resolution presented by Palestinians by a vote of 29 states in favor, one against the United States, and 17 abstentions, including many European Union members. The resolution called for the urgent dispatch of, quote, an independent international commission of inquiry, closed quote, to investigate, quote, all violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law in the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem, particularly in the occupied Gaza Strip, closed quote. The U.S. State Department's deputy spokesperson, Marie Harf, was asked Wednesday to explain why the U.S. was the only country that voted against the resolution.
Why did you vote against forming a panel of inquiry? The statement that was given before the vote by your ambassador there said that whatever steps that the commission would take should be balanced and should not single out Israel. Was it your understanding that what was approved in the end is unfair to Israel?
And one-sided. So we do strongly oppose today's special session at the Human Rights Council and the resulting resolution as the latest in a series of biased anti-Israel actions at the Human Rights Council. We strongly oppose the creation of this kind of mechanism that you spoke about because it's one-sided. No one's looking here at Hamas rockets. No one proposed looking at anything else other than Israel in this case. And again, we oppose it as one-sided.
In her opening statement, the Commissioner for Human Rights talked about the possibility or potential that war crimes had been committed, not just by Israel but also by Hamas. Was that not your understanding of what this commission would?
Well, we were voting on a resolution that had certain language in it and that was looking at certain things, and that was one-sided in nature.
What was it? Is it precisely about the language? Do you know
that it was one-sided?
Right.
In nature.
I mean, but what was that language?
I can pull the specific language for you after the briefing. But
the title of the resolution seemed to be respecting a resolution on the respect for international law and norms in the Palestinian territories, and then including East Jerusalem. Is that problematic?
I haven't seen the specific title. As I said, the resolution in general we view as one-sided and biased, and therefore we voted against it.
So you were concerned that this might turn out to be a Goldstone 2?
Again, we were concerned about it for being one-sided and biased, and something we said quite honestly, we've said in the past, by actions this body has taken.
Does it surprise you that you were the only country to vote against?
There were a number of abstentions.
Yes, there were 17, all of Europe.
Do you and other countries as well? I think there are some countries in there that weren't in Europe, aren't in Europe.
But
look, we make clear, as we have said repeatedly, we will stand up for Israel and the international community, even if it means standing alone. And I think you saw that today.
Okay, but that doesn't tell you anything, though, that you're standing alone.
I don't have any more analysis to do on it.
Meanwhile, more Palestinians were killed in Gaza as Israel continued to pound it Wednesday with missiles and mortars from land, sea, and air. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe spoke with Akram Al-Sitari, who's on the ground in Gaza.
Well, in the last 30 minutes, there was one Palestinian killed every 5 minutes in Khan Yunis area. The Israeli occupation air forces targeted a house, killing two people inside the house, and then targeted a civilian car, killing two other people, and then targeted people in the street, killing two others, making the total number of people killed in Khan Yunis in the last 30 minutes 5 people. Israeli occupation forces also intensified their attacks into the Gaza North, targeting, showering the homes into the Gaza North in Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun and Al-Atatra area with the artillery fire from the tanks that are deployed along the border from the Gaza northern part. The number of people killed in Khan Yunis today is 23 people, and the total number of people killed ever since the beginning of the Israeli occupation aggression against Gaza is now officially 686 people.
And if you want to take a look at what we're going to look in the remaining hours of this day leading into nighttime, what has been the routine here, or what do you see as a pattern, Akram? Does the rocket fire, whether it's tank shelling or whether it's from the sea or whether it's from the air, increase when nighttime falls, or is there overall a pattern that you see in terms of increase or decrease of Israel's bombardment in the Gaza Strip?
Well, the Israeli occupation is using all means to destroy the will of the people of Gaza, to target them and to break them. In the past 15 days or so, we could see the unmanned drones, we could see the war jets of F-16, F-22, we could hear the heavy bombardments coming from the sea, from the warships, the battleships in the middle of the sea. We could see also the attacks from the other fire coming from the border and from surface missiles and from sky surface missiles. The Israeli occupation, I think, has been using all the weapons they have. Some of them were experimented on the Palestinians, and some of them are still being experimented in the Palestinians. So, in conclusion, Israeli occupation used all the weapons they have and all the high advanced technology they have to make sure they can defeat the people of Gaza that are still undefeated till now and are still firing back and fighting in their and standing on their soil.
I'd like to find out from you what Palestinians do when their neighborhoods get hit or when an area gets hit, that houses, for example, a home, and then the Palestinians obviously flee if they are able to flee, if they're not killed. And then they go back to the area. And the reason why I'm asking this is, Akram, perhaps you can tell us and recounts what happened in Shujaia, where you had a Palestinian who went into the neighborhood trying to retrieve either family members or some belongings, and it was reported that Israeli snipers actually killed him and repeatedly shot at him. What types of examples can you give us for Palestinians to return back to the areas where their homes have been bombed?
Well, the all people who left their homes have not come back to their homes yet. The ones who tried to come back were shot dead by the Israeli occupation forces, and most of the people who left their homes under the heavy fire that was targeting them by the Israeli occupation air and ground forces are staying now at the UNRWA schools and are supported by the UNRWA. Some of them moved to some family or relatives' places and they are staying with them, but the landslide majority of them are now housed by the UNRWA and now are being now provided with the basic services such as hygiene, such as food supplies by the UNRWA, and also by some donations given by some individuals and entities such as local NGOs in the Gaza Strip. The humanitarian crisis is still ongoing. People were not allowed to go back to their homes. For example, in Shajaiya, I could see today the smoke, the white smoke all over the horizon in Ash-Shaja'iyya area, and I could hear the explosions taking place there. So there are some activities that are conducted by the Israeli occupation forces in the area. Also in Khuza'a, in Khan Yunis, people were fleeing from their homes under the heavy fire, and they are now being housed by the UNRWA and the UNRWA schools. Palestinians who are fleeing their house are not allowed back to their house, and that is doubling their problems, because after the loss of shelter, now they are struggling to get the very basic services, to get the food for their children, and to get the very needed basic supplies. Now, as I'm talking to you, we could hear a Palestinian missile going from Gaza into Palestine, occupied 48.
Mimi Rosenberg is an attorney and radio host based in New York. She co-hosts Building Bridges, a community and labor report, with producer Ken Nash. She spoke with Mahmoud Abu Rama, Director of International Relations for Gaza's Al-Mizan Center of Human Rights, about the situation that Gazans have been facing for years at the hands of the State of Israel, and we'll bring you that later in this newscast. Although there are still more questions than answers to the question, who shot down Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, the U.S. continues to lay the blame at the feet of Russia, or specifically, Russian President Vladimir Putin. This was the State Department's deputy spokesperson Wednesday afternoon.
On this trajectory thing that you said was put out by the
I didn't say that was new yesterday. We posted that a few days ago.
Right. Uh-huh. But I mean, you know, if you just look at that, a layperson looking at it, it's a line drawn on a satellite photo with nothing to back it up.
Well, as I said, it's based on a series of classified information.
Which we have to take the leap of faith to believe
are trying to put as much out of this, out information out about this as possible. We are trying very hard to do so. It is a process that takes, I think, more time than any of us, certainly you or I, would like. But I think I would make the point that it's much more time consuming to declassify real evidence than to make it up, which is what the Russians have been doing for days now.
Okay, well, be that as it may, are you saying that at some point
to get more information declassified and put out there as quickly as we can? It's just a difficult process.
Okay, but do you understand that given the conflicting claims, no matter how ridiculous you say the other side's version is, and no matter how implausible it might be, but you know, saying that you've put together the imagery showing the root of
trajectory
showing
just one piece. It's one piece.
Well, I know,
of evidence.
But anyone can draw a line on a map. They can. I mean, I'm not
that's
saying
that's not
that
what our intelligence community does. That's not what the U.S. government does when we go out there and present a case to the world.
It was 11 years ago that the then head of the State Department, Colin Powell, made his presentation to the UN Security Council and claimed absolute certainty that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction.
The material I will present to you comes from a variety of sources. Some are U.S. sources and some are those of other countries. Some of the sources are technical, such as intercepted telephone conversations and photos taken by satellites. Other sources are people who have risked their lives to let the world know what Saddam Hussein is really up to. I cannot tell you everything that we know, but what I can share with you, when combined with what all of us have learned over the years, is deeply troubling. What you will see is an accumulation of facts and disturbing patterns of behavior. The facts and Iraq's behavior demonstrate that Saddam Hussein and his regime have made no effort to disarm as required by the international community. Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
Powell later came to regret his presentation. Here, he discussed it with talk show host Larry King.
The information that I was being given by the intelligence community hung together, and I spent 4 days and nights out at the CIA going over it and asking every way I could, are you sure of this? You have multiple sources on this. And I got those assurances. They're the same assurances that the intelligence community gave to the president, the same assurances the intelligence community gave to the Congress 4 months earlier at the request of the Congress, and the Congress passed a resolution supporting the president if he decided he had to take military action. And that's what the president wanted me to do and what I was supposed to do.
You regret it?
I regret it now because the information was wrong. Of course I do. But I will always be seen as the one who made the case before the international community. But there wasn't a word in that speech, in that presentation, that was not vetted and approved by the intelligence community. But that's neither here nor there.
Mimi Rosenberg is an attorney and radio host based in New York. She spoke with Mahmoud Abu Rama, Director of International Relations for Gaza's Al-Mizan Center of Human Rights, earlier this week, about the situation that Gazans have been dealing with for years at the hands of the State of Israel.
Tell us what has transpired in Gaza during the last 24 hours.
We had little sleep last night as a result of the continuous bombardment of houses mostly around us. And it was particularly difficult for the children. Today morning, I came to the office to find out that the number of casualties, of Palestinian casualties, has risen significantly compared with yesterday evening. At least 10 Palestinians have been killed since then. And unfortunately, mostly in attacks that target civilian objects. So it's not very good. The longer this round of hostilities continues, the more danger that we have more serious problems with water supplies, with food, and with other issues. So the pressure is mounting on the larger civilian population. Last night, the Israeli army also dropped leaflets on at least two areas in the Gaza Strip, ordering people to evacuate their houses. I'm speaking about areas inhabited by more or less 200,000 people. Gaza is small. It cannot handle this number of internally displaced persons. People are very reluctant to go to United Nations-run shelters because the road is dangerous, and more significantly because during Operation Cast Lead in 2009, the Israeli army bombarded and attacked 11 UN shelters, killing many people. So people are not sure that going to the UN shelters will be a very good option. These shelters are ready to host a maximum of 35,000 people. We are speaking about much larger populations here. And I think this is why the warnings dropped by the Israeli army are not met positively by people. People have opted to stay mostly at home, which will be, of course, a problem if the Israeli army considers the area as cleared of civilians and starts bombarding it.
Mahmoud, let's get to know you a little as well as we continue the discussion. If you could talk about your work as a human rights advocate in Gaza, which, of course, informs the comments that you've been making.
Well, we're a relatively small human rights organization. We're based in the Gaza Strip. We have three offices here. And we work on documenting and making interventions into human rights violations against the Palestinian population in the Gaza Strip. Whether these violations are coming from the Israeli authorities or the Palestinian authorities. We work under a difficult situation. So, for example, when it comes to the responsibility for human rights in the United States, it's basically very simple. It's the state, the government, the U.S. government, versus the U.S. citizen. In Gaza, it's different. We have multiple duty bearers, people or entities who are responsible for the respect of human rights. We have Israel as an occupying power. Since Israel decided to keep its control, effective control over Gaza, under international law, it is still an occupying power in that territory. And we have a Palestinian government, and still we have very heavy presence of the international community. And all these people are responsible for human rights. So what we are trying to do is monitor violations, whether committed by Palestinian actors or Israeli actors, and making interventions into them, including reporting, legal interventions, advocacy, and other interventions. Every year we monitor more or less 1,000 such violations, and we try our best to do as many interventions which we hope to be successful as possible.
Now, the media in the U.S. has barraged us with a general condemnation of Hamas and the Palestinians for rejecting the alleged ceasefire agreement that was authored by the Egyptians. Can you talk about that?
Yes, of course. I think we've seen this not only in the United States, and this is a rather simplistic way to look at the matter. I think most people miss to grasp context in which this round of hostilities happened. Now, this is only one round of many rounds of hostilities between Palestinian resistance and Israel in Gaza. It did not just happen like that. There is a larger context of occupation of Gaza and the West Bank. There is a constant policy of isolation and separation, so practically fragmenting Palestinian communities in Gaza and the West Bank, basically by imposing a serious blockade on Gaza. And on the 12th of June 2014, three Israeli teenage settlers were kidnapped and unfortunately killed in the West Bank. The response from the Israeli government was massive, was very disproportionate, and was very harmful for the Palestinian population there. So, but, I mean, I think nobody heard about the situation before this round of hostilities started. We are a human rights organization sitting here and watching every day people, patients, who are not allowed to reach hospitals, farmers who are shot and getting paralyzed or killed near the border, fishermen who are shot at, arrested, sometimes killed in the sea, and many, many other forms of aggression and attacks by the Israeli government. Nobody hears about this situation. And I started with this because it's very relevant to how Palestinians in Gaza and how Palestinian political factions in Gaza view the ceasefire proposal coming from Egypt. First, Egypt did not consult with the Palestinian political powers before drafting this agreement. Second, the agreement is more or less a duplicate of the 2012 agreement that also was brokered by Egypt, and it offers mostly stopping hostilities immediately and then discussing going back to previous arrangements. The previous arrangements did not work. This is why we are here today. For Palestinians in Gaza, it doesn't make sense to have a ceasefire agreement which will ensure calm for both parties, yes, but then will leave the Palestinian population under other forms of aggression, including blockading the Gaza Strip, keeping its borders closed, and allowing for other forms of aggression and attacks on Gaza.
Although former President George W. Bush was widely considered a warmonger both in the U.S. and around the world, President Barack Obama is the holder of a Nobel Peace Prize. But according to Glenn Ford, co-host of Black Agenda Radio, under Obama, Washington has been on a path of relentless escalation towards a state of global war.
The United States has set the world on fire. It is nonsense to talk of a new Cold War when what the world is witnessing is multiple conflagrations as intense and horrifically destructive as at any period since World War II. Virtually every one of these armed conflicts has been methodically set in motion by the only power capable of perpetrating such massive, simultaneous mayhem, the United States, along with its underlings in London, Paris, and Tel Aviv, the true axis of evil. Washington is embarked on a mad, scorched-earth policy to terrorize the planet into submission through relentless escalation of a global state of war. Unable to maintain its dominance through trade and competition, the U.S. goes beyond the brink to plunge the whole planet into a cauldron of death. As Russia is learning, it is extremely difficult to avoid war when a great power insists on imposing it. That was a lesson inflicted on the world 75 years ago by Nazi Germany. Whoever coined the phrase, "No drama, Obama," should be sentenced to a lifetime of silence. The first black U.S. president systematically brought swastika-wearing fascists to power in Ukraine to start a war on Russia's borders. The passengers of the Malaysian airliner are victims of Obama's carefully crafted apocalypse, a prefabricated conflict that could consume us all. Obama methodically and without provocation laid waste to Libya and Syria, and now the jihadists unleashed by the United States and its allies are destroying Iraq all over again and threatening to erase Lebanon and Jordan and even the oil kingdoms of the Gulf. Obama has signed yet another blank check for Israel's ghastly war of ethnic annihilation in Gaza, a crime against humanity for which the U.S. is fully as culpable as the apartheid Jewish state, which could not exist if it were not part of the U.S. superpower's global war machine. Those who say the United States is adrift or has no coherent foreign policy are colossally wrong. Washington's policy is the constant fomenting of war for the subjugation of the planet, or the world's destruction, if the U.S. cannot remain number one. The Americans have made Africa into a killing field. Somalia and its people have been smashed and dispersed, setting the whole Horn of Africa ablaze. Ethiopia commits multiple genocides under U.S. sponsorship, while Washington's mercenaries in Rwanda and Uganda grow fat on the bones of 6 million Congolese. South Sudan thrashes in agony, the result of dismemberment by American, European, and Israeli ghouls. The sounds of chaos and mass murder reverberate from the Maghreb in the north through the vast Sahel region and now deep into West Africa, a direct result of criminal U.S. aggressive war and regime change in Libya. Obama pivots to East Asia with the goal of turning Japan into a militaristic state with an invitation to rejoin, after all these years, the game of global conquest. Poor Afghanistan and Pakistan have no future at all unless the U.S. leaves their region and allows them to develop an organic partnership with China. But a world based on mutually beneficial relations among peoples has no room for empire, which is why the empire wages war against the world. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.